Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Before the break, we heard about developments in the effort to detect and treat the blood bacterial infection known as sepsis. You might not think that there would be a natural connection between an interview about sepsis and one about baseball history, but sports writer Steve Rushen has uncovered a little-known but very real link. He'll tell us more about that in just a few minutes. Rushen, who is a columnist for Sports Illustrated and a Marquette graduate, is the author of the book The 34-Ton Bat, The Story of Baseball as Told Through Bobbleheads, Crackerjacks, Jockstraps, Eye Black, and 375 Other Strange and Unforgettable Objects. Speaking by phone from Connecticut, Rushen tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke that the journey for him started with one unforgettable object that belonged to his grandfather.
Well, my grandfather was a guy named Jimmy Boyle who played, I always say, one season for the New York Giants in 1926, but he really played only one game and then ended up getting into only one inning of one game for the Giants as a catcher. And I found out that my uncle in Reno, his son, had his catcher's mitt still. And he shipped it to me by UPS, and I opened this box. My grandfather died 8 years before I was born, so I never got to meet him. But when I took out this 1920s catcher's mitt out of the box and the styrofoam peanuts fell out, I put it onto my left hand, and it was perfectly formed to my grandfather's hand. And it was like shaking hands for the first time with a grandfather I never got to meet. And, you know, I did what most people would do, most men anyway, I think, would do, which was I placed it over my nose and mouth and inhaled like it was an airline oxygen mask. And I really felt like I could smell the Polo Grounds in June of 1926 on a Sunday afternoon against the Pirates. You know, that kind of led me off into wanting to know what his life was like, but also the lives of baseball players from another era. You know, I set off on exploring baseball and history, and also the history of the culture at large through the objects of baseball, not just mitts and hats and bats and balls, but things like beer bottles and bobbleheads and protective cups. And a year and a half later, I came up for air and had this book.
Well, walk us through how you explored this from the present, aside from being able to inhale your grandfather's mitt and imagine being in the Polo Grounds that many years ago. These stories aren't necessarily a secret, but I don't know that there's been a lot written about, say, stirrup socks and sanitary hose in the past. How were you able to make the connections to things that maybe existed for a long time afterward, but go all the way back to what was then known as, say, blood poisoning?
Well, part of it is, how did this come to be? What is the point of this apparently completely pointless decorative sock, the stirrup, that baseball players wore for 80 or 90 years and has started to come back into fashion as a retro thing for some players? And just working backwards and trying to find what was the first appearance of this word in the story, or how did this come to be? And it turns out that baseball players and people in general had a great fear of blood poisoning in the early 1900s. Nap Lajoie, the great Cleveland hitter, was out, spiked, and out for the rest of the season in 1905 and was convalescing. There's a picture in the book of him on his porch with his leg up. And when these players came down with what was diagnosed as blood poisoning, there came to be an assumption that when they were being spiked in their colorful socks, and obviously baseball teams have been known by the colors of their socks for a century and a half, that the color, before color fast dyes existed, was bleeding into the open wound and poisoning their blood. It wasn't the case, but that's what they thought at the time. And so somebody, I still don't know who, decided to cut a half moon in either side of the sock, leaving just a little stirrup at the bottom to hold the sock on in the shoe, and then put an undyed white, quote, sanitary sock under that stirrup. So in case they got spiked there, the colors wouldn't bleed through. Now imagine you're stuffing a second sock inside the first sock and stuffing all of that into a hot leather shoe in the days when players wore the heaviest flannel 8 ounces to the yard that anybody could manufacture and would go out there on 9,500 degree days in St. Louis, say, and heat prostration was also not uncommon. It wasn't uncommon to see players just drop on a baseball field. And these were the kinds of things that you don't often see in old black and white film or see on the back of a baseball card, but you realize when you start to do some research that this was what life actually was when you're riding trains and playing in hot flannel and getting spiked in 1905.
Right, right. You described a scene where one of the teams is riding the trains, and they essentially disrobe and have their clothes airing out in their car as the train would go from one city to the next.
Right, and these windows had screens on them, and so the ash from the smokestack wasn't blowing into the train windows. And from Boston to St. Louis, say, if you were going from the Boston Braves to the St. Louis Cardinals, that was an 18-hour train trip, which is about the distance, you know, you could fly to Australia near that time now. But, you know, that was, people talk about the romance of the trains, and it wasn't romantic. It was only romantic to those people who are looking back at it from our perspective.
It's tempting to just have you roll through some of these stories, but maybe we can focus on a couple more specific areas. One with a good local connection for us here, the man most responsible for the idea of baseball souvenirs actually got his start in Milwaukee.
Yeah, a guy named Danny Goodman, who, was somebody I hadn't known at all prior to starting the book, was from Milwaukee. He went from Milwaukee to Baltimore in minor league baseball. He started out with the Harry Stevens Company and went to Baltimore, sold concessions there. From Baltimore, went to the Yankees' top minor league affiliate in Newark and came up with all of these innovations, including, you know, why should a guy come to a game in a suit, as people did then, and sit down on a wet bleacher seat after a rain? We should sell these guys or rent them seat cushions. You know, what about an umbrella? What about having a fully stocked bar in the back of the bleachers where a guy can come and get a drink during the game or before the game? And all of these things that he came up with, many of them were met with resistance, but some of them were not, including, why don't we sell T-shirts with the team name on it, the Newark Bears, to people? See if they would be interested in buying those. Why don't we sell hats to people? And he became so successful at doing this that Bob Cobb, the owner of the Brown Derby restaurant in Hollywood, guy who invented the Cobb salad, hired him to come west to work for the Hollywood Stars, his baseball team in the Pacific Coast League, which was then almost a quasi-major league team. This is in the early 1940s. Danny Goodman went out there to Hollywood, where he could really sort of let his light shine, and had all manner of promotions, giveaways, and Hollywood Stars of the day came out to the game, not only came out to the games, but many became part owners, Lucy and Desi and Jimmy Stewart and Humphrey Bogart. And long story short, by the time the Dodgers moved west from Brooklyn, the first guy that Walter O'Malley hired when the Dodgers moved to Los Angeles was Danny Goodman. And the Dodgers, forever after, to this day, are the team with the most promotions. Every Dodger homestand was Bat Day or Helmet Day or Jacket Day, some kind of giveaway, and Danny Goodman is largely responsible for that. He's the guy who envisioned in the late 1950s, early 1960s, that fans will one day come to a ballpark and it will almost be a retail store with a ballpark attached. And if you've been to any of the new stadiums, you know that that's exactly what has come to pass.
It was as though he and California were tailor-made for each other.
Exactly. And the Hollywood Stars Stadium ballpark was across from where CBS built CBS Television City. So all of these CBS television stars and Hollywood stars in general who had to pass through the CBS studios there would often lure them over across the street to a game. And when the Dodgers finally moved into Dodger Stadium, he would do the very same thing. And everybody who came to a game, Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., Dean Martin, all left with one of those satin Dodger baseball jackets. And if you can see images of all of these guys in those Dodger jackets. And through that means, those Dodger jackets traveled around the world, and so did the name of the Dodgers. And it made the Dodgers a marketing force.
This is a horrible transition, but the idea of tailor-made reminds me that another unsung hero of baseball, who was foul-proof Taylor?
Well, you say he is unsung, but he also did a lot of singing, because he's a guy who sort of made his living asking people to punch him or kick him in the crotch. And he's a guy who was an immigrant from England. This is around 1909. And eventually worked in a telegraph office in New York and became a kind of an extra in the chorus of the Metropolitan Opera. In the 1920s, he was performing in the background of the Metropolitan Opera when, coming off stage during Act One of Turandot, he was speared by a spear carrier in the groin. Immediately after the show, he went out and bought a supply of rubber cigars and a sheet of aluminum, and he fashioned a protective cup. Went back the next night, asked the guy to spear him. He was fine. And he started taking this invention. He thought he was the first to come up with it, around to New York City boxing gyms and asking the heavyweight champions and contenders of the day to, quote, hit me here. And most of them happily obliged. And he had a real innovative and useful device, not only for its obvious protective qualities, but because at the time in boxing, there was a real problem that if a fight could end on a low blow, if somebody was hit by a low blow, all bets on that fight were canceled. So if a mobster was at ringside and wanted his guy was going the wrong way, he just told him to hit the guy below the belt, all the bets were wiped out. And it came to a head in 1930 in a Jack Sharkey, Max Schmeling heavyweight fight. That was the first heavyweight bout ever lost on a foul when Schmeling was hit in the groin by Sharkey. And so the New York State Boxing Commission had to do something. Foul-proof Taylor always contends that the commissioner of the New York State Boxing Commission favored this other guy, Jacob Gollum, who had invented his own kind of cup. Jacob Gollum marketed that and all of his other boxing products under the brand named Everlast. So Foul-proof never got the recognition he wanted. But he went around baseball clubhouses, the reason it's in the book, trying to sell that and also trying to sell a batting helmet. He kind of changed his focus to protecting batters' noggins. And he went into the Brooklyn Dodgers clubhouse, for instance, late 1930s, and asked players to whack him over the head with a baseball bat. And many of them also obliged. And he also never made the fortune that others made off of batting helmets, which didn't become mandated until 1970. But he was a super colorful character who drank Guinness throughout the day, was the world sack racing champion at one time in his life, and died childless in Brooklyn. And when I talked to his great-niece about did he have any children, she said, no, of course, we assumed his being kicked there 30,000 times had something to do with him not having had children.
And there's another interesting point from a protective gear standpoint. You write about the Major League Baseball logo, which is this, you know, really iconic image. But at the time it was unveiled, it was a little revolutionary because the batter that is pictured is clearly wearing a batting helmet before they were necessarily the norm.
Right. Though a year after they unveiled that logo, batting helmets would be mandated by Major League Baseball. But as with hockey, the players who were already playing were grandfathered in. They weren't required to wear them. And as late as 1979, until he retired, Bob Montgomery, the backup catcher for the Red Sox, didn't wear a batting helmet, even though his manager at the time, Don Zimmer, had been beamed so severely that he very nearly lost his life in the 1950s. But
it's amazing to think of that. 1979, there's still a guy that was going in with just a protective lining in his hat.
It's unbelievable. And the reason that protective lining existed in the first place was even after Ray Chapman of the Indians was killed by a thrown ball, a pitched ball in 1920, players refused to even entertain the notion of wearing helmets because it would make them look chicken. In their primitive minds, that was what people thought at the time. It will make me look like a wuss. I won't look like a man. In the early 1940s, the Dodgers developed the liners with this guy, Dr. Walter Dandy, a Johns Hopkins brain surgeon. And the genius of the protective plastic liners is that they zipped into the inside of the player's hat, so nobody knew they were wearing them. That's why people immediately adopted cups. They were put in your pants. Nobody could see you're wearing them. But obviously, if cups were worn on the outside, nobody would wear them. Same thing happened with gloves in the late 1880s. Nobody wore them until Albert Spaulding, a big star, started wearing them. I mean, just like leather driving gloves to catch the baseball. And once he did, oh, gee, I guess he's a big star. He can do it. I'll do the same thing. And, of course, Spaulding made a fortune off of selling gloves and other sporting goods. But every innovation in baseball, every protective innovation, nobody would wear until stars wore them, and then everybody did. Batting gloves were the same thing. And now, of course, guys go to the plate in medieval armor. There's no stigma attached whatsoever anymore to going up there with as much protective equipment as possible. But that wasn't the story for the first 120 years of baseball.
When you set out to write this book, did you feel like you had to guard against over-romanticizing an earlier era of baseball?
A little bit. And part of it was to, you know, that era has been so romanticized that we have lost sight of what it was really like for these guys. On the other hand, I do have a huge affection for, you know, the baseball that I grew up with. I think everybody, you know, has a nostalgia for whatever their era of falling in love with something was. For me, it was baseball in the 1970s, which doesn't usually inspire a lot of affection, the polyester uniforms and all that. So part of the answer is yes. I think a lesson learned from the book is that anything that the players have done today, players either were or would have done 150 years ago. Would they have taken steroids? Absolutely. Would, you know, mostly they were taking performance-degrading drugs in the late 1880s and early 1900s. Alcohol was a huge problem. Pete Browning, the story is in the book, literally fell asleep off leading off second base and was picked off and, you know, had a huge drinking problem. owners were as crassly, money-grabbing then as they are now. Players the same way. You know, I recognize that it wasn't any different than it is today. Human nature hasn't changed, but I do still have a huge affection for ballpark organists and a lot of the kind of disappearing culture that we've lost. Having said that, only white people could play baseball. There were so many, you know, there was the reserve clause that bound a player economically to his team at the club owner's whim. So to think that baseball was somehow better then is nuts. It's infinitely better now. But it was very interesting the way the game developed.
You thank a lot of baseball people from the Hall of Fame and from really around the world of sports in your acknowledgments. But there's an especially evocative line where you thank your mom as well.
It was Pete Rose against the Mets in 73 in the playoffs, winning a game at Shea Stadium with a home run. My mom, who grew up in Cincinnati, her father was the one who played for the Giants for one game in 1926. And even though I grew up in Minneapolis, outside of Minneapolis, my mom never sort of left Cincinnati. And Cincinnati is where professional baseball started in 1869 with the very first fully professional team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings. You know, she grew up in western Cincinnati, the west part of Cincinnati where Pete Rose was from. My grandfather's brother, Buzz Boyle, played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, but then later became a scout who was instrumental in signing Pete Rose to the Reds. And that sort of all culminated with, you know, my mom dancing in the living room when Pete Rose hit a home run in the late afternoon shadows at Shea Stadium. I had just gotten off the bus, got home in time to watch from school, got home in time to watch the end of the game on TV when World Series games or playoff games were still shown in the afternoon. My mom died in 1991, just a few weeks before the Twins won the World Series in Minneapolis there. And, you know, it's one of the enduring images I always have of my mom. She wasn't a huge sports fan, but the Cincinnati Reds she was crazy for, and so much of that had to do with just what I'm describing here, her nostalgia for childhood, the place she grew up, and the culture that she grew up in. And, you know, part of that, I think, was missing her father, and seeing the Reds winning brought all that back to her.
We probably attach too many metaphors to baseball already, sure. but you can almost think of baseball in a growing up phase, and you know, remembering this era of baseball is really like remembering baseball as a child, warts and all.
Yeah, there is so much in the book about guards against this kind of nostalgia. People throwing beer bottles, empty beer bottles and soda bottles at players and umpires was a constant occurrence that eventually led to the paper cup, so it made it more difficult to physically assault somebody on the baseball field. Umpires getting pummeled at home plate for making bang-bang calls, just all kinds of insane stuff that you would never want to revisit except in reading a book. The warts are plentiful, and baseball has a real problem now in attracting television viewers. They're playing their World Series games that end at 1 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast. But, you know, it's still, for many of us, and I know plenty of kids, too, 15 and under, who still love the game. There's something about, it goes back to that first page of the book, smelling that leather glove, that it just can't be replicated.
Well, Steve Rushen, thank you so much for helping us open that window into this era.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Steve Rushen's latest book is called The 34-Ton Bat. The story of baseball is told through bobbleheads, crackerjacks, jockstraps, eye black, and 375 other strange and unforgettable objects. Rushen, who's a graduate of Marquette University, writes a regular column for Sports Illustrated. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich from his home in Connecticut, and you can hear more of their conversation at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take one last break, and then essayist Mel Miskimmin looks for and finds a sign from her late mother. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.